It's definitely my pleasure to introduce our featured keynote speaker for this evening, Crystal Williams. Crystal is a poet and essayist. She's a professor of English at Bates College, where she is also Associate Vice President and Chief Diversity Officer. And I know she's got a new title, but I didn't make note of it, so she'll have to tell you that. Williams began her career in the arts as an actress, working in Washington, D.C. before moving to New York City. Once in New York, she transitioned from theater to performance and poetry. Williams has published 4 collections of poems, most recently Detroit as Barn, which was selected as a finalist for the National Poetry Series, the Cleveland State Open Book Prize, and the Maine Book Award. Her work has regularly appeared in the nation's leading journals and magazines, and in 2011, she was appointed to the Oregon Arts Commission. By the way, she's only been in Maine for 3 years, and she actually did serve on the Oregon Arts Commission. In her role as a statewide arts commissioner and advocate, she worked to broaden access to the arts and helped the arts and philanthropic organizations operationalize their goals to become more diverse and inclusive. She was on faculty at Reed College in Portland, Oregon for 13 years before moving in the fall of 2013 to Bates, where she is a senior administrator. So we're just thrilled to have her here, and we're very much looking forward to her speech tonight. So come on up, Crystal.
Good evening. I think I'm going to do that. Maybe that. So I am delighted to be here among so many art makers, advocates, and allies in a world in which our communities seem increasingly disconnected from one another, in which our boundaries seem more acutely drawn, our cynicisms and suspicions both more deeply held and more publicly articulated. To be here in communion with you and collectively exploring this issue to do with how do we make the arts more inclusive and equitable at this particular moment in our national history soothes my anxieties a bit. So it's especially lovely to be here tonight. Thank you for inviting me. I'm also delighted to be here, having spent a good deal of this morning in a very productive conversation that Pam expertly led us through, to do with how do we define culture, how do we define equity, and what might that mean specifically in Maine. So thank you, Pam, for that. I also want to, I know there have been a lot of thank yous, but I feel like I really do want to sincerely thank the staff of the Oregon Arts Commission for your very hard work. I understand how much work an endeavor like this takes. So Julie, Kirsten, Linda, RG, Kathy Ann, Priscilla, Chris, thank you. And I'd also like to thank the commissioners that are in the room. So Charles Stanhope, Paul Benjamin, Suzanne Grover, Cynthia Murray, Beliveau, Cynthia Orcutt, and Lawrence Rubenstein. I really want to thank you for your advocacy at the state level. It's important and it does make a difference. So can we just all again thank them? My goal this evening is to help unearth some of the practical approaches that might aid artists, arts advocates, and arts administrators move more assuredly towards cultural equity. But before we dig into that, I think it's important that we collectively have a shared definition of what we might mean when we say cultural equity. There's a definition that I actually like quite a lot. Americans for the Arts writes, "Cultural equity embodies the values, policies, and practices that ensure that all people, including but not limited to those who have been historically underrepresented based on race, ethnicity, age, ability, sexual orientation, gender, socioeconomic status, geography, citizenship status, or religion," "ensure that all people are represented in the development of arts policy, the support of artists, the nurturing of accessible, thriving venues for expression, and the fair distribution of programmatic, financial, and informational resources. It's as capacious a definition as I've been able to find, and I admire its keen focus on values, policies, and practices because, in fact, in my experience, these are the key elements to ensuring our work is inclusive and that we do achieve our goals. That said, I am not a fan of the great amount of time we in the arts community spend focused on the term cultural equity. And not because I don't, you know, not because it's not an aspiration that I hold, it certainly is. I've spent the great majority of my life both as a poet and as an activist, an advocate, an administrator focused on just this issue. Rather, the pithiness of the term cultural equity troubles me. It calls us, I think, to overemphasize the destination and underemphasize the journey, which is where our learning and therefore our transformation takes place. So in recent months, which probably because I've gotten some bit older means a couple of years ago, I'm not sure. there were a spate of news articles, news stories about the health benefits of taking vacation. According to researchers, the greatest benefit to our health, right, so lower stress, heightened enthusiasm, better outlook on life, etc., is not being beneath the sun in Bermuda, actually, if you, right, isn't that amazing? The greatest benefit to us is derived in the planning for the vacation. So the moment that we decide to plan for our wellness, that is when our health benefits go like that, right? And so I suspect that since cultural equity is an aspiration and a destination, the real benefit to our organizations is in the planning for and the ongoing implementation of and the newly developed habits of thought and action that we adopt in our attempt to get to cultural equity. So I thought I'd spend some time tonight briefly identifying four practical sort of tips that I think might be useful just to put into the world, and then a bit more deliberate time on three key points, which I call primary angles of vision, that I do employ regularly to help me ensure that Bates's policies, practices, programs, climates, and cultures are in alignment with our historic promise and our mission. But I think I need to just give you a really brief background for those of you who aren't familiar with Bates. So our college was founded in 1855 by abolitionists who believed that all men and women, regardless of race or class, should have the opportunity to be educated, which is an amazing legacy. And today we strive to live up to that laudable history. That said, like many institutions that begin with lofty ideals, over time, through changes of leadership, lack of integrated and defined action, our keen grip on those laudable values loosened. And we found ourselves, instead of being in the front of the pack, at the vanguard, sort of firmly entrenched in the middle of the pack, right? And our distinctiveness no longer as distinctive as it once was. So we had to take stock and realign ourselves, which is why I'm at Bates College in 2016. So in Bates' story is a reality that so many arts organizations experience, in my experience. That is that without awareness, our vision and value statements, which are important, they don't hold over time unless appended to them are enlivening practices, policies, and traditions. Too often, we develop statements of purpose and then we don't do the work. And so that's my first piece of advice, do the work. My second piece of advice is think about achieving cultural equity as a long-term project that requires strategic interventions and this depends on the size of your organization. So, right, I'm pulling way out to the biggest organizations and you interpret for the size of yours. But it requires strategic interventions at the board level, leadership level, staff level, programming level, community level, policy level. So that's not sexy, but it is sustainable and it will transform your institution. Directly appended to that is the piece of practical advice number 3. Get help. Your expertise as artists or arts and culture administrators likely is not leading deep and systemic organizational development and diversity work. And nor should you be expected to understand and have that expertise. So I'd suggest doing one of two things, or maybe both. One, in future budget years, however small your budget is, account for adding this expertise in your action plans. Number 2, build capacity, and I'll talk more at length about this, but you want to build capacity among your ranks so that the skills on hand in your organization can actually achieve the work at hand. Just as when it's time to complete your taxes, you hire an accountant, so too should you think about the skill set that will help you achieve cultural equity. And finally, the 4th practical piece of advice that I have is find illustrative models. So for most of us, this is not, the, right, getting to cultural equity, being more inclusive, full participation, it's not a values issue. It's a value most of us hold. But we don't, frankly, often know how to translate the value into practice. And that is a failure of imagination, which is not an indictment, it is simply a fact. So I think it's difficult to build something that you haven't ever seen, and it operates using principles that are new and or foreign to you. So my advice, find illustrative models, and I don't mean on paper, I mean get into your car, get onto a plane, get onto a train, on a bike, go across town, and you know, visit organizations and people who are doing good work in specific areas, because what you want to know is how does this thing feel organically? What does it feel like? What are they doing, you know, just in the papers even? And you can't always get that from reports. So go visit and learn and dig into people's thinking. That will, it's actually worth its weight in gold. So beyond those 4 lessons, do the work, take your time doing the work, get help doing the work, and go see how others do the work. In thinking about today's speech, I quickly realized that I'd named the thing practical approaches, but I really couldn't very easily provide a group this size a step-by-step map, because each of your organizations has a distinctive history, emerges from a specific community context, emerges from a specific cultural context, exhibits, right, you have a unique internal cultures, et cetera, et cetera. And in that, I hope, is also a little piece of information for you. So my hope today is really to illuminate the habits of thought and action that undergird the great majority of my work. And there are 3 of them. The first is sequence your work. Think like an architect. The second is build capacity and harness the power of the collective. And the third is think big, solve universal problems. So the first, sequence the work and think like an architect. So we've all been talking about this incredible this incredible space that we're in, and it truly is. And I particularly love architecture for a host of reasons, mostly the way architects are able to manipulate my emotional space, I find awesome. I think it's a fantastic art to have. And this space, to me, suggests communion, grandness. It is asking me to situate my body a bit more reverentially than I normally would, et cetera, et cetera. And I love the practice of architecture in the arts because, to my mind, it is the perfect marriage of vision, artistry, strategy, and planning. You have to have all of those going on often at once in order to get a building made. And architects are often working in the zones that I also am working in. So I work in climate and culture, so how the thing feels. I work in systems and structure, or how the thing is made and delivered, and architects also, right? So whoever designed and built this church had a sense of how they wanted the thing to feel, how they wanted people to be inside of it. Likewise, they had a whole series of systems and structures they had to think about. You can't just put a column and then put some, you know, scaffolding on top of it without it falling down. So that's why I say think like an architect. And if you think in those sequential ways, so if we just pull that apart a little bit, you can think, right, an architect has a primary goal, which is to build the building. They then have a vision, which is to support the goal and to define what the building is that's going to be built. They take environmental scans, right? So where is the building going to be built? What's around it? Are there other buildings, people? Are there other organizations, et cetera, et cetera? They develop creative sketches. They seek input, and that's important. So they seek input from a host of places. They seek the city's input, the state's input sometimes, the planning board, their constituents. They do all of that work in order to understand what their building can and should be. This is the same work that you're thinking through when you're thinking about reaching towards cultural equity. I could go on and on and on, but you get the point, right? To sequence the work and to think in that very structured and strategic way. One of the primary failings of organizations and individuals make as they undertake the work of becoming more inclusive, I think, is that they do not think of the work in these terms: sequence, structure, creativity, and rigor. But by not taking a rigorous and structured approach, you almost inevitably fail to achieve deep, systemic, and structural change. The second is build capacity, the second sort of habit of thought, and action, and harness the power of the collective. In my view, building capacity among your constituents is among the most strategic things you can do, and is, frankly, the only way to get to sustainable cultural equity. And that's because achieving full participation and representation, or cultural equity, whatever we want to call it, it requires an assembly of people with varying levels of expertise, all charged with and focused on enacting the organization's vision and mission with regard to equity, diversity, and inclusion. So I believe in building capacity in all areas of your organization, because from my perspective, the more capacity, the better. There's actually no such thing as too much capacity. But I would suggest beginning with your most strategic group of constituents. So let's just take a little poll. And I'm going to give you four constituent groups from Bates, and I want to know from you who you think is my most strategic population. Students, faculty, staff, or board. So by show of hands, who among you think that students are my most strategic constituent body? Okay. That's lots, okay? Who among you think faculty are my most strategic group? Okay. Staff? Okay. Board? Okay, so that's interesting. Overwhelming support for students as being the most strategic group. In my view, the most strategic group that I focus in on immediately at a college is the faculty. And the reason for that, there are three reasons. One, the faculty are going to be at the institution the longest. The faculty I'm hiring in 2016 likely will be at the institution in 2056 or 2046. I mean, right, so we hire them, maybe they're 30, they have a 30 or 40 year career. They're there a long time. Students are there 4 years. Staff, depending, right, some staff are there a long time, but most staff, particularly professional staff, maybe 3 to 7 years. So the faculty, they see us come and go, come and go. I have faculty at Bates now who've seen, 4 or 5 presidents. I mean, they've seen a lot of presidents come and go. The second thing B is that they engage in multiple, in two areas that are most key to the college. They are in charge of the curriculum, and they are the people who oversee pedagogy. So what happens in the classroom? And what happens in the classroom and what we teach, that's our bread and butter. And the board has nothing to say about that. And then the third reason I think the faculty are my most strategic group at an institution like Bates is because we actually have a shared governance model. So I was a little tricky. I didn't tell you that. but we have a shared governance model, right? So we have faculty committees that actually run and have enormous weight in how the institution is how the institution moves forward. So I've been focused on building faculty capacity in several ways. One area is individual capacity building, and it's related to our classrooms. So it's important, for example, that new hires into the college, that they can effectively teach a broad and diverse range of students. We all know our demographics are changing. They are also changing at our college. And we need our faculty to be particularly effective along a host of kinds of students that are going to be in the classroom, right? So we've got socioeconomic class, socioeconomic identity going on in the classroom, race, ability and disability status, nationality status, political identity, religion. I mean, if there is any kind of diversity you can think of exists among the Bates student population, and they're all in classes together. So we need faculty who can deal with that, deal with it effectively, and actually harness it as a positive element of the education. So, and it's particularly important because classroom climate impacts student learning and success. It impacts our students' feelings of belongingness at Bates and their value at Bates. It impacts their efficacy in the civic world, both while they're on campus and engaged in community service, but beyond when they leave. And it also impacts, frankly, their willingness to engage the college as alumni. So inclusive pedagogy is so fundamental to our institutional mission and identity as a college, and particularly as a teaching college, that it's a skill that my faculty search committees add to their hiring matrices. So this is something they're actually looking for. It's a skill set. Privileging inclusive pedagogy in this way means that in a decade, as my faculty turns over, we'll have departments in which there is deep expertise across all of the members of the department in this area. And won't that be amazing, right? We'll have the physics department just inclusive pedagogy, boom. And what does that mean for underrepresented people in STEM? What does that mean for women in physics? I mean, it means all kinds of things. And building capacity also has side benefits that often go unspoken. So in this case, I know that inclusive pedagogy skills are positively correlated to a host of other skills, related issues. For instance, the broader goals of achieving cultural equity, including the supporting values of diversity within the curriculum, diversity within the faculty, and more deeply supporting community engaged learning. So if I get the inclusive pedagogy right in terms of my students, I also know that these other areas are going to be impacted. You can extrapolate what that means in an arts organization. So in the arts, the question is, what skills do you need to be thinking about? What capacity might you need to have reflected in your hiring so that your strategic and mission-aligned values are more easily enacted over time? That said, not only do you want to focus on building capacity among your staff and board and undertake cultural equity work, as you undertake cultural equity work, but you want to build group capacity. And we can talk maybe a bit later about harnessing the power of the collective. And I'm just going to sort of move through this section a bit more quickly. But when I came into Bates, we were focused on trying to diversify the faculty. And what I wanted to do is understand what was our faculty culture. Right? What was going on? What were the practices that were inhibiting the diversification of the faculty, et cetera, et cetera. So I convened a summer working group of faculty, and I call that harnessing the power of the collective. And from that work, we co-wrote a $1 million grant to Mellon, which we got and now are living that is specifically focused on helping us diversify the faculty. And that grant is undergirded by that summer working group's work. So the power of the collective can really help you. What does that mean in arts terms? It means that if you are a small arts organization in a town, for instance, and you're interested in exploring this issue to do with class, socioeconomic class and diversity, harnessing the power of the collective might mean gathering a focus group of people from the town, right, to have a discussion about that and learn from them how they experience your organization with regard to socioeconomic class and some of their ideas. There are more ideas in the world than there are in your head, and that is a fact. So you know, the challenge with harnessing the power of the collective is you are almost always inevitably going to hear something that you don't want to hear. You're going to be challenged in ways that are uncomfortable, so you have to brace for that. But I guarantee you, it is almost always the case that you emerge a stronger organization by harnessing that capacity. And so, just an aside, I think in terms of building capacity, again, big going small, I think about the board and question all of the structures. Why do our boards have to be 80% financial capacity building? Why is that? Is that a requirement? Are there other kinds of capacity that we need to be thinking about on the board that are actually instrumental to the organization? You want to think about leadership. You want to think about your staff. You want to think about the artists. You want to think about your external constituents, your audience, the members of the community who are not maybe the audience but are instrumental in your goals and so forth. So, and then the third sort of habit of thought that I engage is think big and solve universal problems. Like many campuses around our country, we recently at Bates had the opportunity to work with a group of students of color who expressed concerns about their experiences on campus. And one of the areas they identified had to do with their experience during breaks on campus. And a little bit of background. So Bates has, in the last 10 years, become a much more nationally focused institution. So we've got many more students coming to us from California, Texas, Louisiana, etc. And we because of our institutional mission, have a good number of students. We're very dedicated to access. So we have a lot of students who actually are on very high financial aid, right? So they're getting really wonderful packages because they're so talented and we want them here. But there are questions. So they're making choices. Well, I'm not going to go home for fall break because then I have to turn around and go home, right? And going home doesn't mean going down to Massachusetts as it might have done 10 years ago. It means flying all the way across the country. So they decide to stay. So our culture actually had changed and our practices on campus had not. And they said, well, we can't get food during breaks when you guys close the, you know, the cafeteria. It's hard for us to get over to the, because we don't have cars. And it's hard for us even to get to and from the airport. And there's no programming. And so we convened a working group with the vice president who's over that area, senior staff, and then some students, again, harnessing the power, right? And we came up with a plan to address each of those issues that the students brought forward. What is important to think about is that we both were addressing those problems, but the interventions that we came up with benefit all students. So if you're actually thinking big and solving large problems, what you're, you know, you want to focus on the problem at hand, but you want to also then pull out and ask questions. Well, if students of color are experiencing this, who else might be experiencing the problem? And that's exactly what we did. And so the interventions actually are universal solutions. And that is transformational because everybody then has a better experience. All students have a better experience on campus during breaks now because of the interventions we undertook to address a specific problem. What might that look like in an arts environment? So, for instance, you're a funding agency and a community member complains that there's very little diversity among your grantees. And in fact, when you look at the data, you see that assuredly the community member is correct. You also see that there was significant diversity in the applicant pool, which causes you to ask a series of questions. Why are, and here I'm just, I've racialized this issue. It could be anything, right? It could be any host of things, but in this case, I'm using race. So why are people from racial ethnic groups disproportionately underrepresented among our grantees? What is going on? What are the systems and processes that allow that to happen or that instigate that, right? And then what do we do? So if you're thinking big and solving universal problems, you'd likely and necessarily need to map out the grant making process from, so starting with, what are you funding? The way that you call for applications, right? So how is that written? Where are you announcing proposal invitations, to reconsidering the composition of your preliminary and secondary readers, your choice of final judges, all with an eye towards ensuring, for example, that your judges have the skills to read multiple kinds of literary traditions so that they have some understanding of the quality of work that they're considering within the tradition that that work exists in, as well as within the larger tradition. And you also might consider, right, the composition of the judging panels, et cetera, et cetera. And then, because you're thinking big and systemically, you map out that same process for all of your grants, ensuring that where possible, your entire system is exposed, transparent, and that you've developed new systems and structures designed to address the inequities and biases that are embedded in nearly everything that we do. Further, you provide your grants administrator with the professional development resources, which doesn't always actually require money. It may just require that they get in a car and go down the road and talk to another grants administrator and look through other people's grants. You want to give them the professional development time and resources to develop the skill set you hope that they will adopt. And then, when you next hire, you embed in the job description of the next grants administrator the skill of having demonstrated ability to create systemic interventions that ensure that your organization's commitment to diversity and equity are firmly embedded within all grant-making activities. So that's think big, right? Solve universal problems. Don't stop at the problem at hand. Pull out, pan out, and think across the organization. As you may have ascertained, getting to cultural equity requires a great deal of investigation, a great deal of strategy, cohesive thinking, hard work. It requires that we reassess and redress the normative frameworks that reside silently beneath everything that we do. Our assumptions, what we consider quality, what we consider good, what we consider bad, what we consider art, who we characterize as artists versus hobbyists, all of that needs to be on the table. If we're truly going to, as Americans for the Arts suggest, ensure that our arts policy, practices, programs, access to resources and venues are equitable, we need to treat this as work. And nothing more than robust, clear-eyed action will suffice. So is it hard? Yeah. Is it disheartening sometimes? Absolutely. Will you yourself be surprised by your own biases? Absolutely. Every day I stand in the mirror and I say, how can you say and think that? You are the chief diversity officer. So I want to end with a personal story, because I think ultimately ending on the why is this so important may be important. My 10th grade English teacher, Mrs. Arthur E. Leach, would not be happy with that last sentence. So I spent most of my childhood in Detroit, Michigan, although some years in Madrid, Spain as well. And as a girl, I traveled a good deal, both physically across the country because I had a mother who was intent on driving through the contiguous states. I don't know what her deal was, but so we did it. But I also traveled in other essential ways. First, I was a voracious reader, and I read everything I could get my hands on, as did my mother. Secondly, my father was a jazz pianist, and therefore music was an essential element of my childhood and in our house. And thirdly, my parents loved theater and museums. So I grew up in a family of travelers in which either music, literature, theater, or visual art was typically our vehicle, each offering a novel way of understanding the world and how other people thought about things, how they sounded, how they danced, argued, laughed. And it was this great diversity of art. It was from that I began to make strong assumptions about what it means to be human. So I was going through some photos the other day, and I there were some photos of my mother and I in matching gowns, because back then you dressed to go to the theater, and we did. And we used to go to, my mother loved musicals, so Annie and Oklahoma and Dreamgirls, etc. The ideas for me as a child that at some point, and my mother is Irish American, but you know, she lived in Detroit, so we lived in a black neighborhood with my mother, so this idea that white people could live like on a prairie in cowboy boots and cowboy hat, that to me was just incredible. And that they had ideas about community, that those ideas about their community seemed very similar to the ideas about community that were exhibited or that I saw in Dreamgirls, or that luck could strike a redheaded girl and some millionaire would adopt her and she would then turn to her poor friends and bring them in on the good luck, or that a lion from a magical space called Narnia could be your protector, from which I extrapolated lessons to do with the natural world that continued to fascinate me. All of that together was fantastic in the way that I mean, like actually mind-blowing. And the arc, for example, of a flamenco dancer's back, I remember one day thinking, that looks like a heart. And it made me think of Gauguin's Women in Tahiti. In these disparate types of art, emerging from very different cultural contexts, complete with their own mores and traditions and languages, I learned that I was connected to them all through the very thing that makes us human, our incredible capacity for inner thought and creation. And also because, more personally, somewhere along the line, I ascertained that, in fact, part of what these artists were asking me to understand was their connection to me and mine to them. So this is why I believe that cultural equity is so important, especially in these disheartening times, and especially in a state like Maine, where we have to be particularly purposeful about the way we think and talk about diversity. Art continues to be one of the primary universal connectors between people, histories, and nations. In Maine, our collective work will necessarily mean that we must not only affirmatively embrace those cultures which reside among us in great numbers, so veterans, Franco-Americans, people living in different socioeconomic classes, first Americans, our elders, new Americans, etc. We must also actively shun our passivity about the kinds of diversity not readily seen in our state. I'd like to further complicate the conversations we've been having about cultural equity in Maine and challenge all of us here to reach beyond, whether in our imagination or actually physically reach beyond our state's borders, and bring into the state the important work being done by people from cultures and traditions not readily reflected among us. This was one of the things about growing up in Detroit that I so appreciated. The art I absorbed reflected African American culture, certainly, no doubt. But also it reflected many other cultures that were not so broadly reflected in my city. And as a kid, it was precisely those cultures that were especially different from my own that caused me to make such strong connections, to begin to believe myself part of a larger whole. So Oklahoma, Annie, Diego Rivera, Elizabeth Catlett, Judy Blume, Charlotte Bronte, Miguel Cervantes, all of that was mine. Wouldn't it be extraordinary if Maine's children and adult citizens also were gifted that same kind of capaciousness and vision of the world and their role in the world? Wouldn't it be extraordinary if Maine citizens understood the differences between us, our doorways only, that they are magical openings full of possibility and wonder? Wouldn't it be incredible if we could work to undertake that endeavor collectively? I think it would be, and I applaud your willingness to think rigorously about the work before you. I wish you well in it, and I thank you for it.